There's a very nice, very short one-liner from the Buddha that said that suffering ripens,
navashil,
ripens in a person either as more suffering and misery or as search for freedom. So the ripening of samsara can do two things, go two directions, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. The classic story of the Buddha, how he went on his search, is because of this. He saw suffering, but he saw it, bah, you know, really strong, because he came out of his padded, nicely comfortable palace life as a prince, where he wasn't allowed to see any suffering, and it hit him straight in the face. So therefore the suffering was extremely strong for him relative to what he had before. And the same with Eov. Eov, good life, good person, expectations that everything will be fine, beautiful Beseda. And he got it straight, bah, right, destroying his total life and expectations. So clearly, hopefully we don't have these kind of experiences of major suffering, but when we do, they're really strong to make this choice. Are we going to let these experiences ripen as a spiritual journey, or are we going to drown in them? But there are these choices we make all the time. Because in very small way, every time we have a little headache, or we have an unpleasant thought, or we feel stress, or we feel that life doesn't work for us, or we feel lack of joy, or we feel lack of awakening, we have the same choice to make. Either we drown in it as dukkha, or it brings us to the search, the journey, the opening, the discovery, the freedom, the release. When it's strong, sometimes the power of strong dukkha is to end the illusion of business as usual. I don't know how, there must be a phrase in Hebrew. Same word, iskim karadiyu. It's the illusion that we can, like our parents told us, we're good children, we just do what we need to do, the society tells us, duck, 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 we'll be fine. We're not fine. And a major, major crisis can really wake us up. And this is where we are way beyond psychology. Because in psychology, the agenda is mostly, maybe not entirely, depending on the psychologist, but mostly coping and being happy and avoiding suffering or dealing with it. In some way, coping, hitmodut, working with it to make it less, kind of dealing with suffering. And the awakening is, or the spiritual journey goes way beyond there. It doesn't ask us to reduce suffering. Hopefully we can. No one is saying that the Buddha shouldn't take a medicine, and I'm sure he did. We can. And it doesn't mean to say we have to suffer more. So obviously we will even go to a psychologist if we need to. I don't think there's one Dharma teacher that hasn't gone to a psychologist at some point. Of course, it's okay. Take help where we can, go to the doctor when we need, eat the right food, not get ourselves in trouble if we can, that's sure. But that's automatic. That doesn't need a big story. That just needs care and respect for the body and the mind. But the spiritual journey goes beyond there and is, in a way, utilizing suffering as a springboard, keresh kvitsa, to chinui, to transformation. I mean, the story of Yael, who was going to join this course too, is very, very clear about that. The power of her suffering and the speed at which she really devoted herself to the Dharma. It was the suffering was radical. The whole thing was fast. And she had a radical transformation because everything was up in the air. All the klafim, you know, like I said, no business as usual anymore. Nothing made sense anymore. The whole thing had to be thought up again. What is my life? And so, and she took, it ripened in her to awakening. And I sent you all the link to her video. Just so that you, if those of you that don't know her or haven't met her or haven't heard her can watch it on YouTube, on joy. And clearly, she got beyond it. So the question is, how can it be a source of awakening? And here we talk about the Four Noble Truths. And first of all, the Four Noble Truths are not noble. The Four Noble Truths are ennobling, meaning they make us noble. Little difference, but important. They ma'atzil otanu. Is that the right word? Yeah. They're not noble truths because the Buddha wasn't interested in philosophy. So he didn't come up and say, I've found the truths, and start to sell them. On the contrary, he said, I don't want to sell anything, it's really a drag to have to go out and tell people what I discovered, because nobody's going to understand me. So he actually didn't want to tell anybody. But the Four Noble Truths, or ennobling truths, are very important. And the reason is that you can phrase or understand the journey to awakening in so many different ways. And the Buddha chose to describe it as the ending of suffering. And this is different from so much language which describes exactly the same thing, but in terms of ultimacy, in terms of, you know, hamuchlat, the ultimate, the one, the ecstatic visions of awakening and so on. It's a different language, but it means exactly the same thing. He chose to frame it in this way, but he meant the same thing, that on the subtlest level, suffering is not being awake. That's what suffering is. So the ending of suffering is total awakening. And the fact that we're born into a body and struggle will be automatic, create suffering for us. Nothing we can do about it. No ant, no dog, no amoeba, no virus, no nothing alive is going to avoid that. Because we're born into a form. And a form wants to be a form and not to disappear. So the form is going to want to stay a form. And we all want to stay alive. And that's the basis of suffering. Because life doesn't care whether we stay alive or not. Life is uncontrollable. Life doesn't obey the rules that we want. We want to be forever. Life takes us to pieces, bit by bit. We, with great effort, made ourselves into a body, or we were made into a body, and we are here. And we can stay a little bit, and then we go back. And that's what life says. So all our efforts to kind of avoid that are efforts of a form, trying to stay a form. And you can look at that as major suffering, and the Buddha did that. And so that was his language. We can say, I prefer other languages to describe awakening. Well, that's fine. He also, the Buddha had other languages, by the way. We did an exercise one time with a group, finding more than 100 words that the Buddha described awakening. Unconditioned, ultimate. He used all the same language, by the way. Maybe not the Buddha, maybe all the people after him, I don't know who. He used all those languages, mukhlat, etc., unconditioned. But the emphasis is on suffering and the ending of suffering. So, and the major thing that we, the way that what helps us understand why he did this is to become more familiar with what he really is suffering. Because if we think suffering is pain in the back, and that's it, then we will not understand how awakening is the ending of suffering. So we need to get closer to what is suffering, and that will help us understand what the emphasis in the Dharma. And so we're going to do this a bit. First thing, by the way, about the four ennobling truths is that suffering is to be known. It's not to be dealt with, not to be stopped, not to be busy with, not to be prevented, not to be run away from, not to be denied, not to be covered over, but to be known. That means to be closely and intimate with that voice in us and in the world. It didn't say anything else about suffering. Just know it. And the other Four Noble Truths, of the Four Noble Truths, come then. If we know suffering, we know why we suffer. We begin to understand it's from attachment or clinging or holding on to things. When we let go, space opens that previously was closed to us because we were so busy with our suffering. And so, pitom, if we let go of that busyness with suffering, and suffering is just a known experience that is known, that comes and goes, space opens up. And that space is a space of awakening, which goes on and on and on until it's irreversible. I am sure that Arhants and the Buddha himself felt pain. I'm not sure. I don't know anything. But shall we say, the texts say it, and it's inconceivable that the Buddha is a biological being, human being with a nervous system, didn't feel unpleasant sensations. He wasn't beyond the nervous system of a human being. So he would have felt unpleasant sensations, also the Arhant, also it says so in the text. But I am pretty sure, as much as I can be sure of anything, that an awakened Arhant doesn't do anything with those sensations. They are just there, like a cloud in the sky. And nothing happens as a result of those sensations. No chain of reactivity, of wanting to do anything with it, of stopping it, of feeding it, of worrying about it, of projecting it, of starting wars because you want to get rid of your neighbors that are causing you pain and anxiety, or anything, nothing. Just, it's unpleasant sensation, nervous system is reacting, passing through the system, that's it. So let's look at sort of suffering. Well, gross suffering we all know, so I don't need to talk about that really. It's pain in the body, it's pain in the mind, and sometimes we don't even notice it, even if it's gross. We think it's something else, but we feel disturbed, for example, by what's going on around us, and we don't see it as suffering. But it's actually, we feel anxiety, for example, but it's a kind of a disease, national disease, of the most of the Israeli population, a kind of PTSD. And so it's suffering, but we might not notice it as suffering. It's still pretty gross. You still feel people acting it in their life, and this, something's going to happen, what's going to happen, something's going to happen tomorrow, definitely. If it's not already happened, I'm going to open the newspaper and see the disaster of today. And if not something going to happen, I'm going to make it happen so I can, my anxiety is validated. So clearly we do know, but still usually we know, we can identify more easily strong suffering and big challenges and sickness and violence and so on. And this is a power, that the acknowledging this strong suffering is a power to help us turn away and find another way and ripen into search and not into misery or victim. And there's a very famous and depressing sutta that the Buddha describes this. So you have been warned. You should have a little certificate on this. Only above 18 years old after having sat three retreats. For a long time, you have experienced the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the loss of all your possessions, the loss through illness. As you have experienced this, weeping because of being connected with what you do not want and separated from what you do want, the stream of tears that you have shed is more than the water in the four great oceans. Why? This samsara is without discoverable beginnings. So no, you can't discover the beginning of it. For such a long time you have experienced suffering, pain, disaster, and filled the cemeteries. It is enough to experience turning away or revulsion. It's turning away is like, ichsa, die, enough. It's turning away from it. From all formations, enough to become dispassionate to them, and enough to be liberated from them. So the Buddha is saying, when you see that suffering, allow it to turn you away from formations, meaning this body I have to look after, this world, this life, that, you know, the formations that are us, or and everything else, money, this, everything. So, we think that it's very difficult, but if you look at the film of Yael, you see that it's not that difficult. If Yael can do it, we can do it. And I have here some really wonderful quotations from Etty Hillerson that really express this beautifully. She says, "It is possible to suffer with dignity. I mean, most of us in the West don't understand the art of suffering and experience a thousand fears instead. We stop to be alive being full of fear, bitterness, hatred, and despair. God knows it's only too easy to understand why. But when we are deprived of our lives, are we really deprived of very much? We have to accept death as part of life. And don't we live an entire life, each one of our days? And does it really matter if we live a few days more or less? I am with the hungry, with the ill-treated and the dying every day. But I'm also with the jasmine, and with that piece of sky beyond my window. There is room for everything in a single life. Does that mean I'm never sad, that I never rebel, and always give in, and love life no matter what the circumstances? No, far from it. I believe that I know and share the many sorrows and sad circumstances that a human being can experience. But I do not cling to them. I do not prolong such moments of agony. They pass through me, like life itself, as a broad, eternal stream. They become part of that stream, and life continues. So in the traditional language, dukkha is of three kinds. The first is the gross dukkha that we just talked about, the obvious dukkha. The second is dukkha of change. That means everything is changing, and we don't like that. That's dukkha. We're healthy one day, and the next minute we're not. We have a child, the next minute they've gone up and grown up and gone to the army and gone away. We love somebody, and the next minute the love turns. And we divorce. Whatever. Every minute something is changing. We have a wonderful meal in the best restaurant, and after 2 or 3 hours, we're hungry again. How did that happen? Well, it should have been unchanging and filled me for the next rest of my life. No, 3 hours we've forgotten the restaurant, and we're hungry, we want to do it all over again. change, 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 and we're trying to stop it. The third, more subtle, is the dukkha of conditioning, the hatnaya, which I'll explain a little bit. Dukkha means pain. Dukkha of gross pain. subtle dukkha is there in the very act of perception. And it's something we may not understand, or we may understand, but it is there in the act of perception. When we look at something, there's already in there dukkha. And why is that? Because we can't look at anything without bringing in all the history of who we are, and all the conditioning, and all the busyness with it. So we look at something, we want it, we don't want it, we want it to be different, we want to do something with it, we want to run away from it, we like it, we don't like it, we prefer, we don't prefer. It's busyness with everything that comes in through the senses, even delicate, even though we don't notice it. It's doing things to us. We have a brain that is constructed to respond to whatever's coming in through the senses. And the best explanation of this that I know, one of the best, is the Fire Sutta of Esh. And I sent it to you, I think, in the email. And just reading that, you get a sense that the Buddha said you can't see or think or hear or taste something without chains of responses in the mind, which is kind of bo'er, which is burning. We are into reacting and busy with whatever coming through the senses, and they trap us. The senses hold us in prison, kind of, and that's dukkha. So that on a subtle level, we actually need to be aware of that and see the way conditioning, in a way, closes us, traps us in form, in sankharas, in constructions, in formations, in habits, in tendencies, in personalities, in busyness. And the suffering is our response, the conditioned suffering is a response to conditions. Instead of letting conditions just be there, we respond to them, want to change them, want to do something with them. And of course the image of that suffering is with the arrow, which you know, maybe one of the most well-known images of Buddhism is a person gets hit by the arrow, and this is the first suffering which everybody, including an arahant, will feel, biological pain. But almost everybody except an arahant, when the arrow falls down, will take the arrow and will keep hurting themselves with the same arrow, will be busy with that arrow. Why did it have to be me? Why not somebody else? What can I do about it? I'm angry. The doctors are no good. whatever. On and on and on and on. We do lots of stuff with the arrow after arrow after arrow because of habits of conditioning. And it gets quite subtle. Our ambitions, for example. You think ambition is fine. Well, it is fine to go further in our life and do beautiful things. That's absolutely fine. And nobody's saying you shouldn't do anything and sit at home in case you have ambition. But ambition can be a drive that controls us because of suffering. That we have to change, we have to move, we have to get better, we have to have more money, we have to whatever. We have to solve other people's problems, we have to solve our own problems. Some compulsion, dachaf, that is burning in us. And so it's an example. Memories, restlessness, isheket, stuff we deny, stuff we don't want, stuff we pretend isn't there. Like I talked about the elephant in the room, apil betoch acheda, that we don't want to know about. It's a lot of that is in that territory. So how do we work with this? And how does it we work with it beyond the world of psychology into the world of awakening. I think the first thing, obviously, is what I've just been saying. It is to be known. Suffering is simply to be known. It exists as it is. It exists because we are born into a body. It is doing what it does. Life is doing what it does. It's not our fault. How many people feel blame themselves for their suffering? It's amazing. How many people tend to blame themselves if things don't work, if there's problems, or if they go downhill in some way, or get sick, or become smaller in relation to other people. Well, I don't know. And then starts the blaming. It's not our fault that we suffer. It's in the nature of embodiment, that we are embodied into a body, and then that's what happens as part of being a body. I think it's fantastic to be in a body. I think it's really wonderful to be in a body. You know, it's great. It's a great opportunity, it's great fun, having a good time, and there's suffering. And you can't just sort that out and say, I want the fun and not I want the sukha and not the dukkha. So it's up to us to really become close to and friendly with dukkha, not as an enemy, but as a kind of a truth. It's as powerful a truth as anatta or anicca. It's one of the three characteristics, dukkha, anicca, anatta, meaning it's characteristic of existence. It's a truth about existence. As we are existing, we suffer. There is anatta and there's anicca. We discover this truth about our existence. So it's an important truth. And sometimes we need meditation and we need to be sensitive in order to discover the real nature of suffering. Because it's one of the big differences that separates the sort of sheep from the cows in spiritual life. People who, in a way, often who don't practice, but not always, actually kind of are still legitimizing that they suffer and keep busy around that suffering and wanting ways out and so on. And they can come to spiritual life and read 1,000 books, but it doesn't actually make that much difference very, very often, because they've not seen deeply enough the nature of suffering. So it's a very transforming thing to understand especially the subtle level of suffering and see it not as an enemy but as a visitor. It's not very pleasant, but that is, awakes us up to a truth, to a reality. On the subtle level, what about fear of the unknown? You know, it's, we're afraid of the unknown, the beyond. We're afraid of tomorrow, which we don't know. We're afraid of what we don't know. So here's the suffering. Mostly, if we don't practice, we'll keep that. That will be our suffering. We'll be busy with it. But if we practice, we have a chance of saying, yeah, okay, there's suffering in it, but I'm ready for it. I'm ready for the unknown, and I'm ready for the ability you do, or iyidiya, and I'm ready for, yes, I have some fear. I have some insecurity. I have some pain around there, but that's okay. That's part of the deal. I'm with it. It expresses itself. It's fine. And really, all forms have in them suffering. We are trapped by time. We are trapped by thought. We are trapped by birth and death. Paticca Samuppada. We are trapped by becoming, wanting to be somebody. And all of that is dukkha. So it needs us really to remember all of that and to pay attention and to really get close and intimate with it, and then it's not a problem. Suffering is not a problem. It's a truth. It's not a problem anymore. It's just something that we have dialogue, inner dialogue with. It's like a friend on the journey. It's not a problem. Yeah, we'll die. Yeah, we have pain in the back. Yeah, we have, yeah, okay. It's part of the deal. Here I am in a body, and the body changes. Sadder. So it's this dialogue with it, and intimacy with it, which makes the big difference. As you know, in the Theravada tradition, they read a lot the Chamesh HaTizkorot, and these are sometimes read every day, and they're read when someone dies, and they're a kind of place like the Tibetan image of that you wake up in the morning with a bird on your shoulder that tells you in your ear, this may be your last day. Every day you should imagine this bird on your shoulder that says, this may be your last day. It's not depressing, it's truth. It's a truth that actually, like Eti Hillesheim, helps her to live fully this day. So the same with the Chamesh Tizkorot. Would you like to read them?
בדרך הטבע אני אזדקן, אין מנוס מזקנה. בדרך הטבע אני אחלה, אין מנוס ממחלה. בדרך הטבע אני אמות, אין מנוס ממוות. בדרך הטבע כל היקר לי והאהוב עליי ישתנה, אין מנוס מפרידה. מעשיי עם רכושי היחיד, עם הקרקע מתחת לרגליי, אין מנוס מתוצאות מעשיי.
So, dukkha, the truth of dukkha is like a compass, matspen, that directs us to where we need to look in order to free ourselves. That's why it's important. And on a very subtle level, for example, it's my answer to you a few days ago, Asi, where you asked about Isheket. And the answer was, there's the place. Just go there, because that's your edge. That's where samsara is expressing itself right now. So you want to go there. So suffering is often for us where samsara is expressing itself, and there's our limit. That's where we need to be. And forget who it was. One Dharma teacher said it's like in the map of Treasure Island, Iya Matmon, suffering or hindrances is the X that says, dig here, lach po, here is the treasure. Po yesh et amatmo mitachat ha'ex hazeh b'mapa. It's pointing out, that's why the hindrances are so important. They're not problems. They're invitations to po, lach po, zeh ha'kol shalam, zeh ha'kidelet shalam beitzoa shalam. Zeh b'diuk ha'delet. We don't know where the door is, There's a suffering that's coming up, it's telling us limitation, form, go there. And go there means knowing it, being with it, sympathetic, without losing love, without losing connection to ourselves, without losing connection to life. It is life. We don't need to lose any connection to life. We invite it in. Yes, and you, join the party. And you, the bad back, and you, the psychological agitation, and you. Join the party. It's okay. And but when we see the stuff properly seen, it naturally lets go, because whatever we see, it lets itself go. It goes. If we fully see something, it disappears. It changes. We see it in life, from life point of view. Like Mara, or the entire life of the Buddha, the Mara kept turning up. And all the Buddha had to do was to say, I see you. And he vanished. That's it. The Buddha didn't have to say, okay, I've got to start working on the issue of what Mara is bringing. the Buddha just said, I see you, Mara. And Mara collapsed. And if we fully recognize it, so we may need a little clarity what means letting go. We may need to work a bit on it to have more clarity all the time on non-attachment. Yeah, we learn the skills of non-attachment. Someone once told me, it's a very stupid example, but it just came to mind. Whenever they have an argument with their partner, they look at each other, they don't try and solve the argument, but they stand in the kitchen and take together one step, and they're in another place. Gone.
In the kitchen.
I don't know why, that's why they chose to do this ritual. They have an argument, they don't solve it, they don't sit, I believe this, you didn't do this, you did. They say, oh, one step. So they just step out of the fight. Small example, but we learn to step out of the attachments mostly by noticing that things go away by themselves. Things change by themselves. Nothing stays. Like Etty Hillesum said, it all passes like a stream. The pain may still be there, but it's different every minute. If we respond to the pain, that too can be seen as changing. So one minute, it's not that we asur lanu, because of the fire sermon, Sutta Shala Esh, asur lanu lagiv. There's no asur. To be known, the pain of response to pain, is dukkha. So if we respond by wanting it to shut up and get rid of it, we're already in dukkha. So that too, to be known. Okay, I'm making myself a victim. That's pain. I know that too. But that doesn't last very long. Maybe after 5 minutes there'll be a good cup of tea. Victim is gone. You know, everything is dynamic and flowing. And so seeing that is the major thing. Because when we see it fully, we see that it's part of the flow of life. And when that happens, if we allow, just like Etty, if we allow pain and pleasure to pass through us without needing to do anything with it, we become bigger. And that's exactly what she said. I can contain all of that. And she was in the middle of the Second World War with the Gestapo on the street outside. And every house, as she said, had someone being killed or taken off to the camps. So she's right in the heart of pain. But she said, if I stay with it, then I see the pain and I see the jasmine flower. And because I see both together as part of life, I become bigger. I become less me. I'm less me and more life. Less the subject that has to sort out pain, and more the life through me, passing through me. It's exactly what she said. I am bigger than pain and pleasure, but it's not me really that's bigger. It's less selfing, it's more lifing. I have a couple of quotes that say this from English poets, and I just want to read, very short. But the English is a little bit old-fashioned, so I don't know if you're going to understand it. But I can always do a scan and send it to you, and you can sit there with a dictionary. So Wordsworth writes, "Thanks to the human heart by which we live, thanks to its tenderness, its joys and fears. To me, the tiniest flower that blows can give thoughts that do often lie too deep for tears." And William Blake, who's my favourite English poet, said, "It is right it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe. Woe is suffering in Old English. And when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. Joy and woe are woven, arugim. Joy and woe are woven fine, a clothing for the soul divine. It's beautiful. So our inner Elohut is made, is the clothing of the Elohut, is our experience of joy and pain. Not neutrality, not adishut, not rechuk, not doing things with a joy and having to more joy and less pain, blah, blah, blah. Just, it's woven. The divine in us, the clothes of divine are woven from joy and woe. So more or less, that's what I want to say, but perhaps the last word is to be really sensitive to dukkha when it comes, to really look at it more deeply, to go to the, you know, deepest place and see there is dukkha too. For example, the dukkha of control is the second of the three dukkhas that I mentioned. If we see our way our thoughts seem to control us, they are uncontrollable. We can't control them. They do what they like to us. They are expressing samsara through us. We can feel that's very painful. We can feel dukkha in that. Instead of trying to fix that, I want to make music in my mind, say, no, dukkha is happening. Uncontrollable thoughts are attacking me. I didn't do that. It's not my fault. Samsara. See, it's just life coming through me. That's what's existing right now. So we already meet dukkha there. And we need to kind of see the Four Noble Truths in the microscope. In the moment, in our meditations. It's part of the Satipatthana Sutta. If we look at the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Four Noble Truths are there as one of the foundations. So, clearly, it's an invitation to be mindful of the Four Noble Truths in the moment, when they happen, in this minute. And the final part of being bigger than suffering, of course, is compassion. That it does it by itself. If we are bigger than the joy and the woe, compassion arises by itself. It just, our heart is open. Because we're not running away from pain. We are totally, totally familiar and okay with it. And therefore we can be okay and familiar with anyone else's pain or our own. And we respond to it from presence. And not from anxiety, fear, reactivity, etc., trying to shut it up, trying to run away, trying to deal with it, trying to shut it up, blah, blah, blah. So compassion comes naturally once we feel us, the pain, as part of life and become bigger than it. Thank you. So let's just take a couple of minutes of quiet.